Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, author Deborah Scroggins. Deborah Scroggins, welcome to Conversations with David Lewis.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
A little bit of background on my friend Deborah. She is now living in Amsterdam, but for many years was here in Atlanta reporting for the Atlanta Constitution and then writing on her own about Islam, in particular about the role of women in extremist Islam. Deborah's book, Emma's War, has been a smash success, not only being given rave reviews in The Economist, but also serialized in Vogue. It's in the Hollywood world now, and it's supposedly going to be featuring Nicole Kidman, who was signed to play the part. And Deborah, what are you working on now?
I am working on a book about women and the war on terror here in Europe. Women on both sides.
What do you mean by both sides?
Women who are supporting the Islamists and women who are, some of them, opposing them quite fiercely here.
And so you moved to Amsterdam in particular to write this book?
There are such big Muslim immigrant communities here as compared to the United States. It's more kind of the center of what's happening. And people have the freedom here to say what they think, which they often don't have in the Middle East. And so the discussion tends to be a lot more frank here.
Tell me, which are the areas of Europe? I mean, let's focus our conversation not on your travels in Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan and so forth, because here in the United States, we hear quite a lot about the problems in those countries. But unless there's a big bombing in Madrid or a bombing in London, we don't hear so much about what's going on in terms of the spread of extreme Islam into Europe. What are the countries of greatest concerns?
Well, I think every country in Europe is concerned right now. I mean, Great Britain used to be famous. The French used to call London Londonistan because it was such a center for Islamic radicals. But what a lot of countries are starting to realize is that these groups have penetrated just about every single country on the continent. I mean, take, for example, Denmark. You would never think of Denmark as a haven for Islamic radicalism, and yet that's exactly what the Danes woke up to find out had happened to them. So what's really interesting about being
You're talking about the cartoon controversy,
which was instigated by a group of fundamentalist imams who were in Denmark and had connections to some quite scary people. The Danes really weren't aware that those imams were part of their society.
And where else?
Anywhere you can think of. Norway, Sweden, obviously Holland woke up to these problems, you know, most dramatically with the murder of the filmmaker Theo van Gogh last year. Spain, apart from the Madrid bombings, there have been numerous trials of people who were connected to the 9/11 plotters. Germany is an absolute center for these kind of activities because Germany was the original headquarters of the Muslim Brotherhood here in Europe. Also Switzerland. I could go on and on.
And Germany, of course, is where the Hamburg cell, the Mohammed Atta cell in 9/11 was,
focused on. Exactly. But I have to say that in all of those places that I've mentioned, all of those countries that I've mentioned, there is also this counter-movement developing. And there are more and more Muslims who are standing up and at considerable risk to their own lives and saying, we've absolutely had it with these people. You know, we want to be able to take a critical look at everything, including in some places Islam itself, you know, and figure out where this is coming from and put a stop to it.
Well, that's certainly something we don't hear about in the U.S. I mean, you don't hear about Muslims standing up to the radicals amongst them.
Well, of course, the most famous, you know, one of these people is Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who is the Dutch Somali legislator. And she's actually in the United States this week, having, you know, attracting huge audiences, I believe. She's promoting a book of hers, which has just come out in English, called The Caged Virgin. And she was just given an award by the American Jewish Committee in Washington, and she's spoken at Harvard. And in some ways, she's the most radical of all of these people. But there are a lot of sort of imitators who are springing up in Germany, in Sweden, in Norway, in Denmark. And there a lot of them are women, but not all of them. In fact, in Denmark, the most famous one is a man called Nasser Kader. So it's very exciting to be here. There's a lot going on.
But it is sort of, it's amazing to me how often it is women Muslims who are the ones who are first to speak out against the, you know, Al-Qaeda and its brethren.
Yeah, and I'm trying to understand whether it is mostly women or it's just that they get most of the attention. But without a doubt, there are women. And one reason they are the first to speak out is because women are almost invariably the first group affected by these Islamists when they come to power, whether it's in the home or, you know, in the neighborhood or the country. I say that women are like the canaries in the mine of Islamism. So it's not surprising that they would be the ones, the first group to speak out, because they tend to be affected. In France, for example, there's a woman called Fadela Amara, and she has written about how in these French suburbs, the first signs of the change, you know, came when girls started wearing more and more headscarves. And what people didn't realize is that that was a sign of these Islamists imposing their rules on these kind of forgotten immigrant suburbs. And that was, you know, more than 10 years ago. And what really nobody really recognized is that these Islamic groups, Islamist groups, I want to make that very distinct, like, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood, very carefully
the Muslim Brotherhood is the organization founded in 1928 in Egypt, which is the sort of philosophical, financial, logistical spine out of which Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and many other like-minded groups have grown.
Just want to give a little background. It's the great granddaddy of all Islamist groups, because it's the first modern Islamic group that was calling for Sharia or Islamic law to be the constitution of a world government, you know, or a local government, and for Islamic law to be the basis for everything in society. So all of these groups in some ways grow out of the Muslim Brotherhood. And for about 10 years, it just kind of went along unhindered here and spread its message, and now we see the result.
Is the Muslim Brotherhood the common link between all of these organizations and the ones who are fomenting the riots and protests in Paris and the, you know, heads and the cartoon protests in Denmark and the protests in Britain? I mean, is that the link between all of these extremist groups in Europe?
No. What I compare it to is it's like you can compare it to the leftist movement in Europe, say, at the turn of the century, because there was a whole range of groups who were fascinated by the ideas of Karl Marx. And that was the common, you know, they had a common goal, but they all had different ideas about how to get to that goal, whether it was from, you know, the socialists who wanted to, social democrats who wanted to take a democratic route, to the Bolsheviks who wanted to have a violent revolution. Well, the Islamist movement is like that. They all share the same goal, but there are different groups, and they have different ideas about how to achieve that goal. So the Muslim Brotherhood was the first to sort of formulate the modern goal, but since then it's spread out. And these groups, sometimes they cooperate with each other, and sometimes they compete with each other. Like you saw that with the cartoon crisis, you know, they compete to see who's going to be the most vigorous defender of Islam. And so sometimes they kind of vie with each other to attack the West more virulently.
Yeah, I was just in the Middle East when all of that was breaking and had the pleasure of rolling into Beirut the day after they torched the Danish consulate there. That was
right.
That was great fun.
That was the day you were glad not to have blonde hair, huh?
Well, I must say, you know, from someone who goes to Beirut fairly often as an American Jew and have to be very careful about that, for once I was able to say, hey, at least I'm not Danish.
Right.
So I wasn't the ultimate of evil, at least that week. So how are these different countries in Europe reacting to, they've woken up to this danger amongst them. They're shocked. They're appalled. What are they doing?
Well, every country is handling it a little bit differently. And one of the interesting things and one of the depressing things is that even though they, you know, they constantly kind of point fingers at each other and say, well, you know, the French, you know, are doing it this way. Maybe we should try it that way. No one seems to be coming up with any better answers, particularly. Like the French, for example, have a model of secularism. Everything, you know, to do with the state has got to be rigidly secular. So, for example, they've banned wearing headscarves in school. And they have a very effective anti-terrorist investigative team, and they've managed to prevent a lot of terrorist attacks. But as we saw with the riots in the suburbs, that has by no means ended their problems. So they still got all these problems. Here in the Netherlands, they had a completely different model, which was that they gave the Muslim community funding for basically a lot of separate institutions. And this comes out of Holland's history. This is the tradition in this country, but it kind of backfired because the money that they meant to start Islamic schools and clubs and community halls and so on often ended up in the hands of these very radical fundamentalists who used the taxpayers' money to sort of support their goals and their violent ideas. And it goes on and on. You know, every country has done it a little bit differently, but nobody seems to have come up with a very good solution.
Yeah, I mean, in Spain, where the approach is, I guess, somewhat similar to the previous Dutch experience, where they're throwing a lot of money at them and welcoming them with open arms, an Israeli security official described it to me as the hug-a-terrorist approach. And I guess in every case, only time will tell to see which method works or does not work.
Right.
Do you face any personal danger as you're doing your reporting?
Oh, I don't think so at all. I mean, I don't think so. But, I mean, I don't think there, at this point, there are so many, you know, actual Muslims who are coming out and criticizing these people. And those, and they are under threat that, you know, I don't think they're worrying about people like me. But, you know, having said that, I mean, look at all the newspapers that publish the Danish cartoons, you know, have been threatened. So it certainly is a problem with journalism here in Europe. And then another kind of maybe even more dangerous form of censorship just came to light a few days ago. Ayaan Hirsi-Ali, who again is just the most famous of, you know, of a number of people who are in this situation where, you know, because of their criticism of, you know, either Islam itself or Islamic fundamentalism, you know, have been threatened. And she here in Holland, but she's unusual because she has received round-the-clock protection. And the government bought her an apartment in a building here in The Hague. Just recently, the other residents of that apartment building won a lawsuit asking her to be evicted from that apartment building because they say that her presence there is putting them in danger. The implications of that are pretty terrifying for all the people. I mean, because there are literally hundreds of people under protection around Europe now. Wherever they go to live, can people sue to have them removed? Do you see what I'm saying? So It just adds this other layer of all the dangers and so on that come to pass on these people when they try to criticize. It's really amazing that this can happen, you know, and that people don't see what they're giving up.
Deborah Scroggins, thank you very much for talking with me and being part of the Voice of the Arts here in Atlanta.
Okay, thanks a lot.